Welcome to the American Classroom Podcast, where we discuss the role of education in building a civil society. I'm Jared Taylor, the host, and I'm here with Lindsay Croslin, my co-host. It's nice to be with you here, and we have Sharon Moss as our special guest today. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me today.
So a couple of weeks ago, I saw that you got some education in character education.
Yes.
And I thought, Sharon needs to come on American Classroom and tell us what she learned. But I'd love to hear first and share with our listeners a little bit about your education journey and why you got into education and what you've been up to.
All right. Well, thank you. So I started my career in education over 30 years ago when I was looking for a school for my oldest daughter. And we ultimately ended up in the private faith-based sector of education. And that is where I got my start in being a classroom teacher. And interestingly enough, that is where I met your dad when he was doing his work with the National Center for Constitutional Studies.
Oh, wow.
We used a lot of their resources at the school where my children attended and where I taught. And those early experiences really informed who I became as an educator and my beliefs about education, that it is truly about connecting the heart and the mind. And throughout that process, you know, yes, we had our subject matter instruction and we had our infused, you know, character development through that faith-based lens that was just completely integrated into everything that we did, school operations, janitorial services, instructional practices, student learning experiences. And so that really just solidified, again, that purpose of education is to cultivate character as well as attain that academic progress, right, and achievement. Then I learned not too long after that most schools, if they have a character development initiative, they have their subject matter instruction here and their character development here, and they're completely segregated and they don't, it doesn't really create relevancy for the students. And it just ends up being a compliance measure or a checkbox that the teachers go through. Okay, I did my character lesson this week and then I can move on. And then over time, you started to see those two areas come together, but not to the degree that I experienced when I was in the classroom. From there, I took that knowledge and I started my own charter school in Orem, Utah. It's called Noah Webster Academy, and it was a principal approach to classical education. And so we took a classical approach to education, and then we infused these principles of liberty and virtue and self-government and cultural literacy and individuality into all aspects of our instruction, of our school ethos and culture. So about 3 years ago, when this opportunity presented itself to complete a master's degree in character education, I thought, why not? I am a lifelong learner,
yeah.
And it really has afforded me that opportunity and that knowledge to, I guess, validate what I've always believed to be the purpose of education. And going from the history and politics of character in education throughout, from the times of Aristotle through modern day experiences, to applying virtue, literacy, and character into all of our decision-making processes as adults and inspiring that work within our students.
Sharon, tell us why you believe character ed is such a vital component in today's school.
Thank you for asking that. You know, whether we realize it or not, we are always teaching character in one way, shape, or form, whether it's through the interactions of the individuals within the school community, whether it's in our curriculum choices, our reading lists that we adopt, there is an element of character that is informing those decisions. And if we are not intentionally and explicitly addressing the character development of all stakeholders within our school community, meaning the staff and the teachers and the students, then we are implicitly sending that message that the character of our students is unimportant and that who they are and who they become is of little consequence. And so you have to think about the idea that there is, you're always teaching character, whether it's explicitly or implicitly. And if we're intentionally addressing it, then we're moving beyond that idea of education of just measuring what students are able to do as measured on assessments, but we're focusing on who they become. And there's a saying that, you know, we're human beings, not human doings. And I think that education, the purpose of education truly is to help students become the best person that they can be.
That's great. I like that framework. And maybe that's why so many young boys in particular just feel lost, is because they feel valued just based on what they can do, whether it's in athletics or coding or something, rather than who they are as an individual. I remember in I went to business school at Arizona State in the late 1900s, the early 2000s. And that was when Enron went down and WorldCom went down. And all of a sudden, they started teaching ethics and character in business schools. Like, oh, we forgot about honesty and integrity. And, you know, it's a little late for all the people that lost billions and billions of dollars. But, there's the pendulum has definitely swung. And it's so nice to see people like you and other school leaders bringing this renaissance back of character ed, because if people don't know who they are, do they really care all that much about what they're going to do and where they want to apply their skills or, you know, serve in a community? Yeah, that's huge.
For anyone that has a question that's listening about what is character education, like what is the bulk of it? And, you know, as we talk about kind of how it integrates with academic learning, can you kind of just explain like what is that curriculum or what is that needs to be taught and not only like a K-12 level, but in the higher ed as well?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Let's just talk about a little bit of vocabulary here for a moment, because I will say oftentimes I will replace character development or character education with virtue literacy. So if we think about reading literacy, we're helping students to read fluently and to comprehend and then to be able to communicate effectively, right, through that literacy. We have math literacy with learning our basic facts and being able to problem solve. And so virtue literacy is similar to those two aspects, only with developing, building on a student's perception of what a particular virtue might say, like respect might look like and feel like and sound like in action, based on their age and grade level. Growing their knowledge of that particular virtue and then developing their understanding, helping them to relate and ultimately reason through that lens of respect, and then putting that into action in their life in a meaningful way. And so we'll share some examples of what that can look like through teaching subject matter instruction. But so kind of think of it as this, that you're building this virtue literacy that ultimately leads to virtue action, which positively impacts families and societies, right?
I love that. I feel like I like that reasoning and that how you said that the education turns into action, because I think when you're stating like, well, you talked about who am I, right? Like identifying who you are, feeling good about yourself, knowing, you know, who you're becoming. You can't just in an MBA class be like, it's more ethical to do business this way. And for them to identify with that or that that's the right choice just by like teaching it, right? So I love that, like the steps you kind of outlined is that, you know, study how it's been done wrong, study how it's been done right, study these like virtues or these like, you know, character pillars is how they're kind of described sometimes. And then understand reasoning with them and then deciding like, am I honest in my daily doings? You know, am I, you know, these traits that I'm studying, how do I act in my daily life? And then being able to identify themselves with those virtues that they're learning. So anyway, I love that you kind of outlined it that way. It makes more sense when you're like listening to the.
And sometimes there is some confusion, or the terms virtues versus values get misconstrued or they get interchanged. So just, you know, for your listeners, thinking about virtues as a category of attributes, and that values are your abilities or personality traits. So you can think of it this way, is that virtues are something that you possess and that they represent the intrinsic motivation for the extrinsic demonstration of a value. So virtues are internally possessed, and values are the manifestation of those virtues through your behaviors and your actions. So it's just an interesting, might seem like semantics, but there are some distinctions there.
It matters. People that ignore or reject traditional classical education, they leave out or ignore the moral development of young people, or the virtue fluency. I like that. I think that virtue literacy. We talk about financial literacy. We talk about English literacy, or, you know, other language literacy. And that's a great question, Lindsay. Let me flip that, though. What is it not? Right? You define what it is, but I think for our listeners, it might help them know what it's not. And here's why I think it would help. When I was on the State Board of Education, I brought character ed up a lot. And we were sitting back one time, I'll never forget this time, when we were sitting back trying to look at the way we evaluate schools, the letter grade formula. We're like, is this the right way to do this? And there was a lot of stuff I agreed with, some I didn't, but they said, is there anything that you'd like to bring in here? And I said, yeah, I want to evaluate schools on their character education, or at least give them some points on character education. I won't say exactly what it is. It's not the state's role, but if they do have character ed, we should recognize that and give them an extra bonus point or something like that. I said, there's probably a lot of different ways. And one of those state board members came around and she whispered in my ear, trying to get me to stop talking about this. And she's like, that sounds like it's religion. It sounds like you're trying to push religion. I'm like, it's not religion.
Yeah.
So I don't think she had it clear in her mind what virtue fluency is or virtue literacy is and what it's not. Do you have any comments on what it's not, so people can make the distinction?
I do. So virtues are not the same as religiosity. Okay, so we're not advocating for a particular religion or anything like that. But interestingly enough, a lot of virtues do stem from religious practices. So I can understand why some people have that collapsed and they haven't made that distinction yet. So it's not that. It's just helping people to live their full potential. And so if we look at what are the different types of virtues, there are intellectual virtues, such as critical thinking and reasoning. There are moral virtues, such as respect and accountability. There are civic virtues, such as civility and civic engagement. And then there are performance virtues, such as perseverance or a good work ethic.
Diligence,
that type of thing. And so I think it helps that if you categorize the four different types of virtues, then people can understand that those are those inherent traits that somebody can own and have within inside of themselves and grow and develop. And even though a lot of them can be demonstrated, like, so you can demonstrate respect, but at your core, if you don't respect the value of every other human on the planet, then it's going to be hard for you to authentically respect them in a conversation, right? So that's something that we look at, right?
I like that.
And I think the other thing that character education is not, or the developing of character development, is not through the overuse of extrinsic rewards and motivators that generate compliance.
Behaviorism.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Exactly. It's not that. And nor should it be guiding students or teaching students what to think, but how to think. And so if we not, it's not it's not this lockstep in this situation, this is how you behave and this is how you respond when someone does this, or this is how you, you know, it's not that. It's developing that ability for that student to reason for themselves in this, how would I react in this situation, of course, as they get older, right? And so that is developing that virtue-centric lens for themselves as they go through life.
Oh, I like that. I like that. And I think our listeners also need to know that schools have a role in the development of the virtues in a civil society.
Absolutely.
That's a theme we've talked about in the American classroom, right? We're not the only ones, right? Churches have a role in that. Plus, they'll add sectarian doctrine to that, which is fine. Schools, public schools don't have that. Private schools will add sectarianism sometimes. But of course, the real development of our young people is in the home. But the homes need support as well. And a family that has a strong school and a strong faith to help the formation of their children into a civil society, you know, and what they'd like to be, that's a powerful combination.
It is.
Right? We talk about education is a team, it's a team sport.
Yes. You know, it really is a sacred trust that parents are instilling into the teachers of their children. Is ultimately the stewardship for educating a child rests on the parents. It's their responsibility to ensure that their children are educated. And so in a state like Arizona and in growing states around the nation, we're having an increase in universal school choice. And so parents are having greater opportunities to seek out a school environment that reflects their values and their parenting style, how they want their children, or who do they want to partner with in providing the education for their child. And it really is a sacred trust that teachers are empowered with. It really is.
It's a big deal. I tell my school leaders and teachers about half of what our scholars are going to learn is from what they look at and they observe compared to what they hear you say.
Yeah.
So that's why we have to have absolute fidelity to our core principles and our mission and our vision, effectively the things that we tell the parents that we're going to do as a school. And our teachers have stepped up quite a bit. The teachers we have in our academies, Heritage Academy and Paul Revere Academy, our sponsoring organization. But that's a big deal. And I think that's one of the things parents are really shopping for, is that teacher with those high moral values, because they know they model that. They bring that back into the home.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the greatest influencers especially for our older students, because they will absolutely pinpoint if a teacher is inauthentic in their approach.
How long does that take?
Minuscule seconds, right?
Exactly.
Their perception is spot on. If that teacher is inauthentic in their trying to mold their character, but they are not worthy of emulation themselves, they're going to shut down. They're going to turn off, right? The other thing is that if a school does have a list of priority virtues or correct of principles, and they're nothing more than platitudes on the wall, and they're not a part of that lived experience that really is ingrained in the ethos and culture of that school, they can feel that as well. And so it's that environment, and the research shows is that the school environment is really the number one indicator of a student's success.
You spend 6 hours a day. Yeah, the term we talk about is fidelity. Right? Or say-do gap. You should have no say-do gap, what you say and what you do. There should be absolute fidelity to, and things happen, life happens, right? But get right back on our core virtues. But let's get into the research a little bit.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about what you learned through the course of your studies. And it's so nice that there's a renaissance in character education and research. And we'd love to hear the latest that's being taught.
Yeah, so there really is a renaissance. And I have to say that I feel like we are in this third great awakening, if you will. I think since COVID, a lot of parents have really become more aware of what their children's schools are and are not teaching. And so I think that that really has shown a light on the need for character development, on traditional, universally accepted principles or basic or simple truths, right? Things like civility and respect and courtesy and integrity and, perseverance.
That's common across so many cultures and religions and civilizations. Yeah.
What are these universal principles rather than getting into obscure ideologies, which is really trying to frame what a student thinks rather than how they think, right? And so through the work of several different organizations, there really is a renaissance, a resurgence of this focus on character education. But the research is really very interesting. Like I said, in the last 10 years, there's been over 2,000 peer-reviewed articles written on the effectiveness of character education, and that does not include independent research that has been peer-reviewed by different universities that are actually incorporating this character development component into their teacher prep programs. So that is really an exciting move that we're seeing right now.
Great.
That there were several people in my cohort of the cohort that I just finished with the master's that are at the university level. And like ASU, GCU, WGU, there's several smaller universities in the Southeast and throughout the Midwest that are all starting to incorporate this idea that that to become an educator is that you really are a character educator, and that this isn't just something that we tack on to the academic instruction, but it truly is, should be the vision and the mission of what drives you to become an educator. And so I think we're going to see some exciting changes in the coming years with the new teachers that are coming in from those teacher prep programs. But to the research point, people want to know, okay, how does character education impact academic outcomes or student behavior? And, you know, how does A lead to B? It's a coin toss. It's a 50-50. I think anyone is going to find whatever it is that they're looking for, they can find it. They can find research to support either if character education is effective or if it's ineffective. One thing that I did, the commonality that I noticed is that there is very little research out there that looks at how does the adoption or the implementation of character development or a character education initiative inform instructional practices that lead to the student outcomes.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
They jump from A to B without looking at the journey of what it takes to get from A to B. And so if you adopt a character education program and your instructional practices are mediocre at best, well, are you going to have an increase in academic outcomes? Likely not. So that was a big part of my research, was looking at, even though I titled it, what are the motivational factors that influence a teacher's engagement and cultivating character in the classroom. It really focused on their planning and instructional practices and student learning experiences. And because that is that middle road right there. And so from an academic standpoint, I think there's definitely a lot more room for additional research out there to really focus on the instructional piece. There are studies that have shown that effective teaching for character development aligns with best practices and instructional methods that do lead to academic achievement and improved behavioral outcomes. So as we talked about this idea of virtue literacy, it is that acknowledging the perception of the students of what a particular virtue looks like and sounds like respect, building that knowledge and growing their understanding, helping them to reason and relate, and then putting it into action and cultivating those habits of character. And so when we talk about these instructional practices, the teachers that are really effective, and I would dare say the ones at Heritage Academy, I know my granddaughter goes there,
right,
and she shares different stories of, you know, what things that her teacher shares with her.
That's great.
Is that teachers who are intentionally infusing character development into their planning and instruction and the student learning experiences are asking higher level questions. They are helping their students to make inferences from their literary text and their historical documents. And they're looking at literary and historical figures and scientists and artists and in the time period in which they lived and how did their character impact the society of their time? And is that a character that is worthy of emulating? Or was this someone whose character was less than worthy of emulating? Because we can still learn from
sure.
those individuals as well. The making of inferences increases comprehension and critical thinking on the student's part. And it's done in a very authentic and relevant way for the students. It also includes the guiding of students through the process of relating with those historic and literary characters. Which develops that reasoning. From the student aspect of that, it increases the relevancy of subject matter content because they've put themselves or they've somehow made a connection, whether it's that literary character or that historical figure, they've connected with them in some way that is personal and unique for them. That increases their engagement and ultimately their ownership of their learning, which we know those are the things that lead to academic improvement. And then, of course, we see that virtue action into their lives as they are living these principles that they've then begun to share.
And I think that even though we would hope that every home is teaching character education and that's like the kid would have some foundation before they come to school, I think a lot of kids are just being told, like, you need to be more respectful or you this or they're, you know what I mean? Like maybe they don't really know what it means to be respectful. And so I think by studying it and seeing people, okay, this person was known for being, they were respected in their community and they were a respectful person and kind of what that behavior looks like and then learning about what that looks like and then being like, oh, okay, if I want to be more respectful, you know, maybe there's something on the report card about being respectful to their classmates, you know, whatever it is that they can start to make these connections and decide if they want to change their behavior based on what they're learning. So,
yeah. So sometimes one of the challenges for school leaders, if they are wanting to, you know, improve their character development of their students and their staff, or they want to begin an initiative, is that teachers often feel like this is one more thing on their plate. And I think what we need in this area is a paradigm shift, is that it's not one more thing on the plate, but it is the plate. And that should be the foundation upon which we build. And, think about often, we ask the question, what do we want students to know and be able to do as a result of this lesson, right? What do we want them to know, be able to do, and become? And can I share an example?
Yeah,
that,
please.
Okay.
Yeah,
so I brought, interestingly, I was cleaning out my storage unit this weekend and I found some like old goldies from when I was in the classroom.
Nice.
But this is the story of Heidi.
Oh, classic.
And this was a teacher read aloud when I taught second grade. And it can just be as simple as you're reading a literary work that as you're analyzing the characters in that literature and maybe creating a T-chart of what are the external characteristics and the internal characteristics. The external characteristics, of course, are the things that we see with our eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But the internal characteristics are the things that we feel with our heart. And so we help these students, even at the youngest ages, make that heart and mind connection in everything that they're experiencing within the classroom. And so there is a passage here where Peter is a goat herder And he is, Heidi is meeting him for the first time and meeting the goats. And she's noticing that everyone had quite a distinct individuality and its own peculiar ways. And so let's think about that for just a moment, is that that is that principle of individuality, which if we understand that, so if we're developing that virtue literacy around respect, is that, okay, to say respect is say please and thank you, is to be kind, is to listen when someone is speaking, and all of those are absolutely true. But internally, it stems from valuing the unique contribution that everybody offers, and that there are no two blades of grass on this entire planet that are exactly the same. There are no two leaves on any tree that has the same veining. There are no two children that are exactly alike, and that we all have strengths and we all have weaknesses. And where I might be good at something, you might struggle. And where you're good at something, I might struggle. But collectively, we can help each other to be our best selves, right? And so even just from that very simple sentence, we can teach these incredible principles and then ask the children to identify, how are they unique? How are they different from their siblings, right? Then there is another example where Peter was sharing his lunch and he had very little to eat. And Heidi had an abundance with her. Said Heidi broke some of her bread into it. The rest, a piece still larger than all that Peter's bread, she handed it over to him with all her large portion of cheese and said, "You may have that. I have enough." And then Peter looked at Heidi in speechless amazement, for never in his life had he been able to say such a thing or give anything away. He hesitated a little, for he could not really believe that Heidi was in earnest. She went on offering the bread and cheese, and when he did not take it, she laid it down on his knee, and then he saw that she meant it for him, seized the prize, nodded his thanks, and then made the most satisfactory dinner of his goat herd life. That simple act of kindness and generosity was the best meal that Peter had ever had. And so in that context of the story, is A, we're going to acknowledge that the character of Heidi is one of she's generous. She sees a need and she takes care of it. She served Peter she didn't give him all of her food. She maintained what she needed for herself, but then shared her abundance. And then we can have a conversation with our students. Have you ever received service from somebody? Has someone ever done anything kind for you? How did that make you feel? Have you ever done something kind for someone else? How did that make you feel? And then you can even extend that and bring in that school and home connection. And I think communication is key, letting the parents know that through our literary study, we had this authentic conversation around service and generosity and receiving service and giving service, and invite parents to have a conversation with their children about how can they serve each other within the context of their home. Or if they're so inspired, to then maybe participate in a family service project. So I think those are the ways that we lay character at the foundation of all that we do. And then it doesn't feel like something else that's being added to our plate that's already full.
That's great. I love that. And there's so many great teachers that will send home a weekly email or a monthly saying, this month we're going to focus on this character attribute.
Yeah.
And parents will pick up on that and say, oh, good. Okay, I'm going to see how that's being developed. I'm going to shape some questions at the kitchen table about that. And they can layer that in. I love what you're saying. It's great. It reminds me of some of the research from Paul Tough and Angela Duckworth on grit. And they talk about how parents can reinforce some of the teachings in the school with some simple language changes of, if they do well in math, it's, hey, Lindsay, you did so great in math. You're so smart. To Lindsay, you did great on this test. You worked really hard at that. you know, to identify that virtue that led to the success. Other than that, because the next test, you know, she may or may not do as well. Oh, I'm not that smart anymore. Right.
Right.
But
yeah. And I think to your point is having that shared language around your priority virtues or what you've identified as a school or an organization that you're going to focus on. And hopefully that is done with stakeholder input, right? When you're first starting a character initiative, is that you're getting input from parents, from teachers, sure, yeah. from your school leaders, and creating something that really is a reflection of your mission, vision, and values, right? And then that constant encouragement to utilize that shared language, because then it increases that relevancy for the students. I'm not just respectful when I'm in Mrs. Moss's class. I'm respectful everywhere I go because it matters.
And I love the questions around how did you feel when you demonstrated those behaviors? You know, how did that feel? Because a lot of times it's like, okay, Tommy, if you share your tractor with Bobby, I'll give you a cookie. You know, and sometimes the extrinsic can turn to intrinsic, right? But essentially, we're saying, when you shared, how did you feel? When you did this thing, how did it feel? How did the other person, how do you imagine they felt in that exchange? And so I think having them identify the feeling inside and then understanding that, and really, I feel like a lot of this ties to, what do we want to be in life? We want to be happy. And a lot of that, you know, the Happiness Project, the study that they did for like 70 years on people who are truly happy throughout their life. And it's like relationships, right? If you have major character flaws, if you're not respectful, if you're not honest, you're not going to have close friends and connections. You know, you're probably not going to find lifelong happiness. You're probably not going to be able to stay in relationships. You know, maybe not be close to your kids. You know, there's all these things that, by understanding it at a young age and then building strong relationships that'll last your lifetime, being the type of person somebody wants to hire or work for, right? Because of the things you've learned and practiced and been like, yeah, this is like what helps me be successful and respected in my community. So anyway, I just feel like it really, these foundational things are going to build people into being the type of people that we want to interact with in our community and that build a happy, like, civil society.
I'd like to share just one other experience, because it's also tied to the study of Heidi, is, and this is one that I didn't see this as a teacher. This one came out of left field, but this was, we studied this in the spring of the year. So we had majority of the school year. And of course, these virtues were all started in kindergarten, built on in first grade, added to in second grade, that the true magic happens is when the students, independent of your guidance, start to relate and reason independently through this lens. And there was this one experience, and it's just something that will stay with me forever and ever, is that there was a little boy who was pretty much a non-reader in my class, was really struggling. The year prior, he had some trauma in his life where his 2-year-old sister drowned in a Lake Powell. She died in a Lake Powell drowning accident. Parents were grieving. He was grieving. It completely negatively impacted his learning experience, and he was shutting down and he was giving up. And getting emotional, I wasn't going to do that. Through the story, he made a connection and made a change in his life that no one else could have done that for him. He did it himself. But Peter is about 12 years old in the story, the goat herder. He doesn't read. Heidi is 5. They've become friends. Heidi is going down to visit Peter's grandmother, and she's trying to teach Heidi how to read. And Heidi says, "Oh, I knew I couldn't do it. It's just too hard." And the grandmother says, "Well, that's an interesting thought. Who told you that it was too hard?" And she said, "Well, yeah, people can't learn to read. It's too hard. Peter told me so, and he knows about it. He has to keep trying, but he never can learn. It is too hard." And the grandmother says, "Okay, now, Heidi, I am going to tell you something. You have not learned to read yet because you believed Peter. But now you must believe me, and I tell you really and truly that you can learn to read in a short time like a great many children who are like you and not like Peter. And now you must know what will happen when you can read. You've seen the shepherd in the beautiful green pasture. As soon as you can read, you shall have this book of your own, and you can learn his whole story just as if someone told it to you. You would like to know this, wouldn't you, Heidi? And she did, and we're going on, and we're reading the story. And this student raised his hand, and I called on him, and he goes, Mrs. Moss, I'm like Peter. And I said, okay, do you want to? Yeah. I've believed that I can't learn to read, and I believed it's too hard, and my grandma has wanted to tutor me, and you've wanted to help me, and I've just believed that I couldn't do it, so I haven't wanted to do it. But now I'm going to be like Heidi, and I'm going to learn how to read. And
what a sweet story.
Wow.
Trying not to bawl,
yeah,
right?
No,
in that moment, because I didn't make that connection, but he did, because he had started to be comfortable with connecting with the stories. There was something that resonated with him, and he had the courage to share it with all of his classmates, because his classmates knew that he was a reluctant reader, that he was struggling. And at that day, at that moment, he made a decision that forever changed his educational life. And he started to, in earnest, practice. We used Riggs, which was a form of Spalding. He started practicing his phonograms. He started doing better on his phonogram tests and his spelling test. And he started working with me a little bit more and working with his grandmother, who was tutoring him. And lo and behold, he began to read. And that following year, with academic testing, he wasn't quite up to grade level, but he had made huge gains. And then he said, I am going to persevere like the pilgrims. Even though it's hard, I can do it. And so talk about relating to these, you know, historical times. So he brought in the historical time period that we had studied earlier in the school year about the pilgrim character traits and the things that they had to endure, plus the literary connection. Is that, again, I can't reiterate enough, is how that character is the foundation of planning. And then from an academic standpoint, I wasn't planning on doing this, but then we asked the students, who in your life has inspired or encouraged you to do something that was hard? And then, okay, I knew that coming up, we were going to learn the proper letter writing format and write thank you letters. And so why not this week? So what I was going to do in 3 weeks, I decided to do right then because it was relevant and guided the students through how to set up a letter, to write a thank you letter to somebody. And then everyone else had an opportunity to reflect on someone that they wanted to express gratitude for encouraging them or supporting them in something that was difficult. And so then in subsequent years, this was actually a part of my planned curriculum because it was just such a beautiful experience.
Fertile ground.
Yeah, it really
is.
So many
seeds can be planted, and that's great.
Yeah. And then I think as students get older, you know, the experiences are even more powerful, is that when they are in charge and that they're in control of their learning to that degree, and that they're making those connections as they're consciously forming who they want to be and who they are, is that they can utilize these the greats from history and from literature to use as models for their own character.
That's huge. I mean, there's a reason they call it the formative years, right? They're forming so many parts of who they are, and they have virtues, right? The moral development, it really, really matters in those ages. And we're lucky to be in that space, you know, as in this K-12 world.
How do you see students respond to character education? Like, you were a teacher and you implemented it, and then also in your research and your master's program, like, How do students typically respond to these programs being taught or dropped into the school?
The younger children are definitely much more receptive just by nature of they're still wanting to please their teacher and they're just still, you know.
They're so fun.
They're just still fun, right? And so, but again, it all depends on the approach. And we talked about that earlier, is that your older students can definitely tell if you're trying to shove something down their throat that they are not interested in, or if you're inauthentic about it, or that if you are trying to teach them what to think versus how to think. And so I think for the most part, if it really is a part of, and again, the research supports this, is that if you've created a school environment, an ethos, which think of the ethos as the guiding principles of your organization, and that informs everything that you do. And the culture are the actions and the behaviors. That's what you can see, right? And so I think if there's congruency there, your older students are going to embrace it and live according to those principles. The other idea too is that if the character education aspect is productive versus punitive, then there's going to be a greater acceptance of that in their life. So if they're constantly being, for the older, the adolescents, the high school kids, junior high and high school, if they're constantly being called out about how they're not exemplifying virtue, then they're going to feel like they're always failing. But at the same time, there are consequences for our behaviors and our actions, but we can present that to a student in a productive way. Is, you know, if there's a correction that needs to happen, is guiding them through that process of acknowledging how was this behavior, was it in compliance or not compliance with this particular virtue, or was it living this virtue or not, and help them to take ownership of that, and then create a plan with them of how they can do better in the future. And so I think it really all just depends on how it is approached. And again, if they see the school leaders, the teachers, the staff members, if everybody is living the virtues and the values, then they want to be a part of that.
I'll make that connection to these virtues lead to happiness. These virtues lead to success. These virtues are ends. They're not means. You know, we're not honest because we're going to get a star, right? And that's why I like what you pointed out earlier. It's not a behaviorist standpoint. It's good because it's good of itself. It stands on its own feet. It's not good because we're going to get points, although there's a role for that to some extent, but it's not, it can't all be behaviorism, you know, carrots and sticks.
Right, right.
But I want to ask you a question about archetypes in, I don't know if the research or anything, or if you have comments on that approach to teaching the moral development. You know, Heidi in some ways is a model, right? And there's other models that people use. Did the research that you studied say anything about good or bad in terms of looking at archetypes, in terms of the virtue literacy? And
yes, I didn't focus on that necessarily for my dissertation.
Okay.
But in one of the years that we looked at, and some of the professors are doing some extensive research on the influence of stories. So to your point, of does the character in the story need to be a reflection of the age of the student that is reading that story, or can they relate to an older individual, right?
Sure.
And so there is some emerging research coming out around that, and it is very effective. But again, it is all in how it's implemented. So if the teacher presents a story as an archetype or work of literature and then demands that the students act and behave in this way because of that, then it's going to fail, for most children, right? But if they're asking, but if they're employing those best practices in instruction and student learning, then they're going to guide the students in for them coming to that realization themselves. And that's where that true learning and that connection of the heart and mind happens, and where students and teachers are then more committed to developing their character rather than being compliant to just being this way in this class at this time.
I think relevant stories can be so impactful too, because, you know, you might have a student, middle school, high school, it's had a really hard life, and you have a high school teacher, you know, trying to emphasize these pillars, and the student's like, easy for you to say, you know, easy for you to say, you've had an easy life, you know, I have it hard, it can't always be honest, I can't always be whatever. And so I think stories can be so impactful in seeing how other people have gone through that might have been similar to your journey, and then being able to connect with those people and, you know, and try to be like, no, that's the type of life I want to live. I don't want to repeat how I've grown up. You know, I want to inspire to be more. And so, yeah.
So both of you mentioned the word happiness. So, Can I just segue into something just really quick?
Yeah.
Because there is a, talking about character education, building the strong communities and a really healthy civil society. And we talk about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I want to quote a couple of our founders, if you will. So, right.
Heard so of those guys.
Sam Adams said this, and this was just a really interesting quote. A general dissolution of principles and manners will more surely overthrow the liberties of America than the whole force of the common enemy. While the people are virtuous, they cannot be subdued. But when they lose their virtue, they will be ready to surrender their liberties to the first external or internal invader. If virtue and knowledge are diffused among the people, they will never be enslaved. This will be their great security. And then I want to just take you through a little bit of a word study real quick. So this is my favorite thing to do.
Yeah,
kind
that,
of a self-proclaimed
powerful
word note. Yeah, isn't it? So think about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Aristotle said that the aim of our studies is not to know what virtue is, but to become good. And that when, as society, people are good, we have human flourishing. And I really love the term flourishing. Flourish is not only to be happy. I really don't feel that our founders were saying, in the life, liberty, and the pursuit of eat, drinking, and be merry, right? And the surface level happiness, okay? And that flourishing is not only to be happy, but to fulfill one's potential through the development of intellectual, moral, and civic virtues. And so to your point of that student who's had a hard life, and, you know, it's easy for you to be happy because you've had it easy. Well, I think we can guide that student to say, you know, everyone has this equal opportunity to fulfill the potential that's within them. And that we can use this idea of this character education to unlock that potential within the student and help them see and grow where they, where they're strong, is to help them build on those strengths and help them shore up their weaknesses so that they have that opportunity to live up to their potential. And it's not the same as someone else's potential, right? So maybe our founders were saying, to a degree, is that life, liberty, and the pursuit of human flourishing, or living up to our potential. And then with that, what is the word that is generally that happiness is replaced with? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They
property.
Say property, right? And so, granted, I do feel like our early settlers were looking for land, property rights. But James Madison said that conscience is the most sacred of all property. And that is what informed several of the amendments, right? freedom of religion, freedom of press, freedom of expression. So I wonder if the founders have this idea for of an American society where it was life, liberty, and the pursuit of fulfilling one's potential according to the dictates of their conscience that is informed through the development of intellectual, moral, and civic virtue. There's a lot there if we unpack the word happiness.
We feel happy when we're being true and living our values.
Yeah.
Right? So like we get to define what our values are, and are we living true to them? And so I love that statement.
Yeah. So if conscience is the most sacred of all property, it's something that we own, no one can take that away from us. And our conscience can be informed by the development of these virtues that we put into our life so that we can live up to our fullest potential.
Yeah, that's powerful. And character education helps people reflect a lot about themselves and what they're thinking and who they are. Not in a negative way, but in a way that helps them think, yeah, I actually did demonstrate diligence, you know, on this math assignment or this science assignment, or this reading assignment really was challenging, but this next one I did okay. So, you know, it's a process of reflection, and, you know, if you own your conscience, right, then you can own the development of that conscience and the education of that conscience and the education of your desire to become or strive or whatever the word you want to be better. It's very fertile ground for personal development. And the American classroom has to have that as the underline. I love how you pointed that out. I mean, the right to life was the very first part in the Declaration for a reason, I believe.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's not to just say I have a right to be alive, right? It's that's one of the what are they? It's one of those obvious truths,
right?
But there's just so much more to it. To be good and to be moral and to be a person of integrity, and then I think you can climb the ladder of ultimately be someone of service and of value to others because that's who I am. I'm a serviceable person.
Exactly.
No, that's great. That's powerful.
Yeah. And to be able to engage in a debate of ideas in a civil way and in a respectful way. And it's not that everyone has to believe the same thing or to be the same way, but that we're at least all going in the same direction toward a civil society.
So, yeah, on that same topic, in your view, how does character education connect to building these communities in a civil society? Like, how are those, like, critical to each other?
Oh, I really feel like they're indispensable to one another, right? All we have to do is turn on the news for 5 minutes, and we can see how the degradation of society is playing out in our life because of the lack of character among the citizens. The cultivation of character and virtues has been a part of the educational landscape since the beginning of time, really, since way back. And it really was during that school reform era of the 80s and 90s where there was an increased emphasis on student learning outcomes. There was a lot of good that came out of that, but there was such a hyper-focus on outcome-based education and rising of test scores is that the cultivation of character went by the wayside. And we do see a resurgence of that. And I think that it is in response to all of the horrific things that we're seeing that are happening in our society today. A principle is a basic or simple truth, and they're universal. And as a society, if, and I don't say that every single school has to adopt the same set of principles, right? They need to do what's good for their community. But generally speaking, I think if our children are taught to respect life, respect the contribution of others, and to practice civil discourse in being able to allow somebody to state their viewpoint and acknowledge that viewpoint, but then still be strong in their convictions of what their viewpoint is, then I think that that is what we have lost, generally speaking, in education. And we absolutely need to get that back so that we don't have a continuation of all of the negative things that we're seeing in our world today.
Yeah, we're taping this in October of 2025. And recently in the news, we've just seen a political assassination. And we've seen someone effectively put a bomb and shoot in churches and burn down a church. And some of the underlying characteristics is they just have dehumanized these people that they believe are their enemies. And that's not what civil societies do, right? We understand what pluralism is. We understand that people are going to be different. No blade of grass is the same, right? And just because someone's different doesn't mean they're not human. And there's terrible deterioration in cultures that lose that civil base and those virtues. We've got to get that back and it has to start in the classrooms and the kitchen tables. That's what Ronald Reagan says. All great change in America begins at the kitchen table, right? The classrooms have to support that. And the churches have to support that. I mean, we're the offensive team. It's got to happen for some of this madness to stop. Well, Sharon, this is a great, great conversation here. Tell us, what else would you like to cover here before we start wrapping up? And we want to give some advice to some school leaders about if they'd like to up their game in this area of character development. But we'd love to see what other research you might have to share with us on this. You're just coming off an incredible study of character education. So we'd love to hear what you've been learning.
Well, as far as, let me touch just a little bit more on the research, is that if, and about with a school leader, let's say a school leader, you know, has a desire or already has a robust character component of their educational model, and they have priority virtues in place, is that I think my number one encouragement is to hire for commitment to character, and then teach or train for compliance to everything else, right? So interestingly enough, in the individuals that I interviewed for this, and this was a complete shock to me, is that 97% of the teachers that I interviewed from across the country that represented different school types, district-run schools, charter schools, private faith-based, and then there was a homeschool group, like a micro-school type of experience that was represented as well. 97% of those teachers already had a personal philosophy of education that valued the character development of their students, and that a lot of that was informed by their personal parenting practices or by an example of a teacher that they had. If they were a younger teacher, they remembered how they felt in a teacher's classroom when they were growing up, and they wanted to replicate that. So it was already part of their educator DNA. It was their personal philosophy of education that we're not just teaching content, that we're cultivating character. And they were drawn to their schools of employment because of the priority virtues or the character development that was already in play. And so the environment of that school, the ethos and the culture were a magnet for those teachers in aligning themselves within that organization. And so I think it's huge. I cannot be overstated how important the feeling is when you walk into a school. Is you can walk into any school building in this country and you can get a feeling in the first 3 minutes of what their priorities are, what their mission is, what they stand for, what the collaboration is like among the staff, and what they're striving to achieve within their community. And so I think that is of vital importance.
That's huge, because school leaders now are worried about enrollment, among other things. They're worried about test scores. They're worried about enrollment, especially those in states that have pretty liberal school choice laws. And when we get when I ask parents, what do you like about it? That's what they say. I can feel something at this school, right? They don't say, oh, I like your math curriculum. Right? Or like your English curriculum. Sometimes they do. But a common thread is, number one, it feels good in here. Number two, your values align with my values. And number three, they say, your scholars are happy. They're laughing.
They want to be there.
They want to be
there.
They're
creating an environment where students want to be, right?
And to your point, that really is a derivative of that positive cultural base where you have teachers bought in and teachers living the values and the school leaders exemplifying that and holding people accountable. And so that's a big lesson, big takeaway for school leaders listening to this, is if you want to turn that school around or continue to be great, evaluate that culture, evaluate those values, evaluate your character ed program, and make sure it's not this thing on the side, right?
Is it a lived experience among all the stakeholders?
Your community knows it.
They will come.
Yep.
There was a meta-analysis done in 2019 that unequivocally stated that through their research, and this was, researching all of the other researchers' work, was that there was just a small percentage of parents that chose a school because of their character development initiative.
Oh, really?
Okay. I don't think they interviewed any parents in the state of Arizona, where we have widespread school choice, and that is one of the predominant factors of why a parent chooses a school. But they just said, universally speaking, that was not in their top five. Essentially, they were looking for, convenience, hours, academic achievement, that type of thing. But interestingly enough, from 2020 on, that has shifted. And so now more parents are absolutely looking for that school that is in alignment with their values and how they want their children to. They're looking for a partner then we're looking for an organization to partner with to educate their children. And yes.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I mean, a lot of families, when schools shut down, started evaluating, why am I sending my child to this school? We did.
Yes.
My youngest daughter switched schools from a district school to a charter school. Not Heritage, because we didn't have one that, for those grades. But a lot of families, why am I even in public school? I should be homeschooling, right? They started to ask a lot of those whys, and maybe that's, who knows why they started.
Well, and if you can't homeschool, you really want somebody to partner to be able to reinforce those things, right? If you're like, okay, I can't homeschool full-time.
You don't want the school to undo what you're trying to do in your home through ideologies that you're not in alignment with. And I think that's where we just need to have, we need to have an informed electorate. We need to have an informed parent population of what the schools are, what they're doing.
And schools shouldn't be afraid to talk about it.
Exactly.
Because good character education that's in the DNA is probably your best discipline policy anyways. It's your best classroom management.
It absolutely is.
Right? It just makes those much lighter.
Yeah.
Well, Sharon, this is great. Looking forward, what does character ed look like 5-10 years down the road? Where do you see this?
Well, hopefully it's turning our country around.
Yeah, right? Amen to that.
In a positive manner and returning that respectful civil discourse back into society.
We have to.
But this is happening around the world in schools and in districts and in countries all over. There are many, many individuals, organizational leaders and university leaders that are participating in this master's degree because it is something that that they're even feeling in their countries is a need. That we've just gone too far away from these principles and these values that have made us a strong society. And we've got to get back to those basics. And it doesn't mean that supplants our academic rigor. In fact, it enhances it and it improves our academic rigor. I did try to demonstrate that, the research, again, just to reiterate that the best practices in teaching character development are the same as the best practices in academic instruction that lead to improved student outcomes, is they don't have to be mutually exclusive, is that they can be integrated. And when they are, that's when you have that true learning that happens. And I think the greatest thing that we can provide for our students is that environment where they take ownership of their learning, and that they really do resonate and connect and have an increased relevancy. Within the humanities, it's easy to do this in the literature and in history. That's where my passion is. I love both of those subject areas. I love teaching those. I love reading historical fiction. I love history. I love it all. And when the students have an understanding, not just a knowledge, but an understanding, and they can reason through this virtue-centric lens and understand the contribution that our founding fathers and mothers made to make this nation what it is, what it was destined and designed to be, then they'll have a heart for returning us to those principles. So that is my hope. It seems like it might be a lofty goal for 10 years.
Love it.
but I do feel that the political assassination that you referenced just a few minutes ago, In Charlie Kirk's life, I think he significantly undid in 10 years of the time of his work in what he was doing. In 10 years, he significantly turned the tide of what progressive education has spent the last 60 years trying to accomplish, which is to have control over the hearts and minds of our youth. And I think that is what we need to get back to. Again, I know I've said this a few times, is not infusing into our students what to think and what to believe and what to do, but how to think, how to reason, and how to act through this virtue-centric lens that will serve them well and will serve society well for the rest of their life.
Oh, this, yeah, it's so nice to talk to someone who's so passionate on the topic, and we appreciate everything you've shared with us. And in our show notes, we can put a link to maybe some curriculum that you recommend. I don't know if you'll feel comfortable sharing something like that, maybe links to some of the research you referenced. So for our audience members, we can put links to a lot of the content if they're like, where do I,
find
information on implementing it into their school. So
if I could just end, Noah Webster stated, "The virtues of men are of more consequence to society than their abilities. And for this reason, the heart should be cultivated with more assiduity than the head." And the future of our nation is dependent upon our virtue and our courageous action to act upon those virtues that are instilled through education. And so it has been an absolute pleasure to be with you guys today. And I will send, you know, some links. And it's been great. Thank you.
Sharon, thank you. What a treat to have you on American Classroom Podcast. And the things that you shared are just critical, not just for the individual lives of our the children in our schools, but the families and the community and our nation. So thank you. And I want to thank all of the listeners of American Classroom. I know that you're going to take a lot of great lessons away. Lindsay, as always, thank you for joining on American Classroom. Great to have you here. And Sharon, thanks again for these wonderful thoughts and ideas.
Thank you again.
If you like this episode, please like and share with someone who would find this interesting. We appreciate you listening to the American Classroom podcast today.
Thank you.
American Classroom is brought to you by Heritage Academy Mesa. Heritage Academy in Mesa, Arizona is a public charter school serving grades 7 through 12. Youth that come to Heritage are not just students, but scholars who are taught by the number one rated faculty in Arizona. If you'd like to learn more about Heritage Academy Mesa, please visit heritageacademyaz.com and click Mesa.